So there are the two bases, the gross material one, which is an effect, and the lowest effect of all is the low beat of the gross mineral world, and the other base, which is the highest frequency, the frequency of the absolute, on which all the other frequencies are loaded in this manner. The highest frequency, and then through continued application of itself, on itself, it vibrates, and again, the highest frequency is still on it, and this wave will get bigger and bigger. It will vibrate even on itself, like this. So there's a little wave on top of a wave, and there's a little other frequency on top of that. Now, if you understand the meaning of this diagram clearly, you will know that you can never be out of contact with spirit, because spirit is actually riding on your gross material body. When you identify with your gross material body, you are identifying with the slowest beat that there is where you are. It isn't the only beat there, it's the slowest one. It is identification and the need for gross material experience that causes us focusing on the slow, because the slow is easier to learn first. But riding on it, there's another beat. And riding on that, a very, very fine beat, and so on. If we said very roughly, you've got a gross urge, a slow periodic impulse. It might manifest over a moon cycle or some other astronomical division of time. That can be felt as a definite rhythm. On top of that, you have another one, a feeling rhythm, where you like and dislike things over periods if you watch yourself. On top of that, you have a thought rhythm. And so, in its pure form, the top level thought, not derived from contingent stimulation, is pure logos. That would correspond with the higher mind of certain schools of thought. The lower one being the continued one. Question goes on to say, if we consider our biggest circle, the universe, the biggest possible vibration again is the grossest, and therefore not the fundamental. The highest and finest must be the fundamental. Again, if we consider our actions in the world, we say they are gross. Our thoughts are higher in the scale, but are still not fundamental. The highest and finest must be the fundamental for all things. We say that the universe is light, precipitated into gross matter. Does this line of thought justify us in saying that the commonplace terminology is back to front? Well, we've already dealt with that. It isn't back to front, it's just looking at reality from the slow end instead of the fast end. And we need to look at it from both ends, but it will always be looked at by human beings from the bottom end first. Because a human being is concerned with the bottom end, as a baby is concerned with the absorption of gross matter in order to grow. And therefore he's orientated towards that. And it's on that basis that he must grow progressively towards spiritualization, which is why St. Paul says, first a physical body, then a spiritual body. The attempt to become spiritual too soon is always abortive, because spirit is form. It is understanding, it is intuition, it is immediate perception. And it cannot be got without going through the steps from the physical, through the expression of gross blind urges, and then through those urges into painful situations, and through the painful situation into thought, and from the thought feeding back onto the urge, gradually to elevate it, to change its phase, and thus lift it up to higher frequencies until finally it becomes spiritual. But there is no essential difference between gross matter and spirit. There is only an actual difference. There's an illustration here. In radio, a carrier wave of high frequency is used as a fundamental and is modulated by a lower or gross frequency, the audio frequency. It can be modulated in amplitude or in frequency. This is similar in effect to this diagram of the waves of different lengths superimposed on each other. Can we look at the universe in this way and say that it is an immense number and variety of modulations of a very high frequency carrier wave? And would this be the true fundamental? Well, we've seen that that is so. Let's look at something now in relation to this, because we're talking in musical terms. When we're talking about music, we're dealing with a very, very strange thing, which only within the last 1,000 years has begun to develop and force man into a consciousness of time, whereas prior to that, he didn't have a proper consciousness of time, apart from a few brilliant intellects like St. Augustine. He dealt in terms of space instead of time. St. Augustine was one of the earliest thinkers to consider time, and what he considered about it was that when he didn't think about it, he knew what it was. But when he thought about it, then he didn't know what it was. It was very, very subtle. Now, Zeno, one of the Eleatic philosophers, had proved that motion was impossible to his own satisfaction and to the bewilderment of some Greeks. And this kind of paradox still persists in school textbooks, although Hogben, I think, has exploded it to his satisfaction. Now, we talk about the motion of things, but in terms of gross objects, motion is the appearance of an object in place one, and then its disappearance in that place one, and its appearance in place two. So that from a materialistic point of view, motion is always of bodies. And it is always of a body in place one, and then not in place one, but in place two. Now, Zeno's point was this. In order to pass from place one to place two, any body had to pass all the spaces in between. Now, if there is no locus, no place other than where a body is, but only infinity, then between any two bodies there must be an infinite number of places which it must occupy. Now, if it takes time to move from one place to another, then if there are an infinite number of places between place one and two, it must occupy one of these places in a given moment of time. And if there are an infinite number of such places, it will require an infinite number of moments of time to traverse the distance. Which means to say that the object can never get from place one to place two, because it's requiring an infinite time to go through the infinite spaces between. Therefore, he said, motion is impossible. Now, this has been dismissed by materialist thinkers as a sort of verbal quibble. But it isn't a verbal quibble at all. It happens to be a fact. If motion of bodies existed in the billiard ball sense of bodies, then it would be very, very strange indeed. If we take a materialistic concept, let's take one billiard ball, isolate it, pretend there is only one of it, and that there are no others, and we've defined place as that which is marked by a body. Now, imagine infinity and one billiard ball. There's nothing to mark what that body does, if anything, against. So there can't be any other balls for it to be near or far from. And consequently, the whole concept of change of place cannot be introduced. If we have infinite space and one billion ball, motion is impossible. Now, if we introduce another billion ball, I start talking about motion, thinking to solve it. What we get is that when we look at ball one and ball two, and the space between, In one moment of looking, we will say the space between is an inch. And in the next moment of looking, half an inch. The space between is shrunk. And in the next moment, it will be a quarter. And then finally, there will be in contact. The space between has shrunk. Now, the materialistically orientated mind is quite satisfied to say that the balls have moved. And that's because he wants to say that. The other aspect of it, equally valid because of the law of equal validity for opposites, is that the balls didn't move, but the space between them shrunk. Now, if they postulate that this space between is nothing whatever, then they're up against a much worse problem. Because if it be true that there is a body and another body and nothing between at all, that's an entirely closed system and no force is radiating across space, because if there were, then the space would be formed. If there were any isolated bodies with no radiation between, those bodies could not in any sense act upon each other. So there would be no ground, no cause for any motion whatever. So if we exhaust the space between our power, of forces, immediately we cannot account for any motion whatever. Now these are all very, very deep paradoxes. Let's look at it musically. We often hear about the movement of a passage in music. We get a bit of music for a moment. This is a notation. First of you write A, C and E. It's an A minor. Now, a musician will play this note, and then he'll stop playing that note and play this note, and he'll stop playing that one and play this one. Now, what has moved? He played the one note where he played it, and that didn't move. He played the next note where that was, and that didn't move. He played the next note where that was, and that didn't move. And yet we're convinced that something has moved. But it can't be the note, because every note was blown where it was, and that's somewhere else. Now, there's a theory called associationism in the psychology of musical appreciation. But this theory cannot be true, and it's been devised to account for things, and it cannot account for them. It says that if we create notes, one after the other, in this manner, and notice it's begged its point immediately by saying one after the other, there arises, by continuous repetition of this, expectancy in the mind. And this expectancy gives rise to the phenomenon of a sense of dynamic leadingness in a melody. A melodic line seems to want to go somewhere. The associationist says that this is untrue, that there are no notes trying to go somewhere, that the fifth does not try to go to the octave, but that by repetition of fifths and octaves we are led to believe, as it does. A piece of music is simply a series of separate notes played, sometimes on one, sometimes on many instruments. But between the notes lies significance. If we had a magical instrument with us now, we could prove it, because we could blow or play separate notes and discover that if we played one of those notes only, it would not point anywhere outside itself. And if we play one note on its own, therefore, it has no dynamic content. It doesn't try to go anywhere at all. It's just itself. Let's pretend for a moment we're going to play a note, and we'll call that note 3. We just play a note 3. Why have we called it 3? Because at the back of our mind we have another note called 1. Let's write the first 7 letters of the alphabet, if I can remember them. This is the basis of our musical notation. Suppose we number them in this manner. Now, if I note 1 on its own, I don't expect anything from it at all. If I throw that A in isolation, there's no motion tendency to go beyond itself. If I now play C, following it, and then I go back and play again the A, and then the C, I seem to feel that the thing is trying to move in a given direction. Supposing I now play the E, and then I play the A above here again. When I do that, after I play A, C, and E, I will hear in my mind that A beginning to sound again. Maybe not too high, but it's still the same A. There will be something in there that is coming in, and it doesn't reside in any individual note. It cannot do. Because if we take any individual note out and play it on its own, it leads nowhere. But as soon as we start playing a sequence, there's something in the sequence that demands that we finish it in a certain way. If we take, say, the seventh note of a major scale, it screams out for the eighth. If we take the fifth note, it shouts out for the fundamental, or its octave. And this is something not in the note. This is very, very important. It is not in the note, and funnily enough, it is not between the notes. Because if it were between the notes, then we could play one note, and another note, and the thing would develop only in between. When we'd struck one note, there'd be no pointing, and then a betweenness should start, and then we'd play the second note and recognize it. When in fact we play the first and the second note, we anticipate something, not between the one and the two, but elsewhere. It goes to another note. So it isn't between one and two, but it's somewhere else. Now, it has been suggested that instead of writing it in that way, we postulate the spiritual fundamental, that is the highest frequency there is, the top bass, and hang down from it here in this diagram, particular ones that would represent waveforms slower than that, and we would then find that the betweenness of these is nothing other than that other vibration, and that the thing that is causing us to feel the dynamic movement of tones is the fact of the eternality of the vibration of spirit underneath them all. When we strike one note, we don't find any tendency to go anywhere at all, because if we trace it back into its center, we will find that which never goes anywhere at all, namely infinity, the spirit. And in itself, at a finite end, it can't point. It's rude to point, and billiard balls don't point because they're spherical. They're not dynamic, they're not going beyond themselves. So at the back of all these harmonies, we find there is this other frequency, the spiritual fundamental. Now if we play a chord, that is, if we play, say, a triad here, three notes, one above the other, simultaneously, unlike the experience we have when we take a single note, which points nowhere, we find that the chord itself has tensions within itself that demand resolution, or are satisfied with themselves, according to the nature of the chord. We play a certain, say, a major triad there, based on the fundamental, we will feel satisfaction with it. We won't want to move it. If we play the chord of, say, the dominant seventh, we will find the tendency to want to move it. Now, the cause of it is this. On the spiritual level, of top frequency, the other frequency, all these motions are tied together by the fundamental unit of the frequency of spirit. And playing them together. If we take a series of different notes at the gross level, different tones, and play them together, it is equivalent to introducing a disequilibrium complex in the absolute frequency. And that frequency itself is therefore made unjust, like we said about the judges not corresponding with the universal. So as soon as we play these derived notes, we have introduced a particular strain. And the other frequency will now try to pull back those things into their proper relation. We then find that the betweenness of tones rests on this other frequency, on spirit. And we can now see a very peculiar thing, that of all the arts, music is the supreme art concerned with time. We take the other arts, most of them deal with space, architecture, painting and so on. They deal with space, and space appeals to the eye. Now the eye is only giving us the mediated reflection of light from surfaces, and therefore is superficial. But music is giving us a time process, and is penetrating into us with its longitudinal waves, hammering into the depths of our being instead of just shining on the surface. And is carrying us into an awareness of strains introduced in our own spiritual being. So that when we hear music, we actually find that by the harmonic progressions within that music, our soul is stretched and compressed. And in this, we are led to become aware of our relation with the Aleph frequency. It's because of this deeply moving power of music that all the primitive religions, and by primitive I don't mean inferior religions, all the great religions in the early world used musical instruments in their religious services. The removal of these instruments has been one of the reasons why the church lost influence. Each instrument has power to affect the soul by straining it and stretching it in certain ways. We know the difference between the tone of an oboe and of a violin and of a trumpet and so on by the harmonic pattern and the attack on that instrument. And that harmonic pattern is the same thing as a distortion of our psyche. If a man is in a certain condition of disequilibrium in himself, and certain tones are played to him, certain harmonic structures, and just put at him, they will bring him into harmony with that bass line, the high bass, the other frequency. Orpheus is credited with making the trees and the mountain tops, the trees bow themselves, etc., with his music. Now, this is not just mythical rubbish, it is a statement about the inherent harmonic structure of the universe. It's what Pythagoras was nibbling at, and it's what modern ultrasonics is niggling at. Therefore, we can tell by a person's reaction to certain intervals, intervals of spaces between, and the betweenness of tones has to do with this other frequency strain. We can tell by the way he takes a major interval or a minor interval and so on, what state of soul he's in. All the repressed problems of his life constitute tonal distortions, harmonic movements. And if we feed into him certain musical structures, they will cause reverberations in his being and make him acquainted with these repressed distortions, and they will then start to come out in emotional display. You will become conscious of things under the impulse of music that without it you would not become conscious of. And this is one of the chief functions of music. Now, modern philosophy is concerned more with time than it is with space, because time is still more mysterious than visual space. Visual space we can draw geometrically and measure it. But time, unlike visual space, which we can measure on paper or on the Earth's surface, has a habit of disappearing into the past and of not yet existing in the future, and of existing only in a moment which is dimensionless. Because the essential thing about now is that that now is on a non-existent point. Our past is continuously disappearing. Our future is not yet arrived. And when we try to concentrate on what now is, all we can see is something disappearing from a non-entity into a non-entity. And that now, therefore, has a very, very peculiar quality, which we call immediacy. Immediacy has to do with spirit. Because eternity, spirit, is the only now. And what we call now is an abstraction, sandwiched between two portions of eternity, which we call the past and the future. And all the forms of the past and of the future coexist in eternity. And by a certain process of harmonic abstraction, our organisms are produced, and they are themselves harmonic complexes, which are disequilibria of the absolute. We exist as individuals only because we are in disequilibrium. This essential disequilibrium of the individual has to be embraced. This is the meaning of the crucifixion here. One very, very good psychologist, and therefore not very popular, said that the wonderful thing about man, when he has attained awareness of himself, is that he becomes adjusted to his maladjustment. Now he's saying that we have to accept the necessary disequilibrium of the finite being. The other pressure, the absolute frequency, the seamlessness of Christ's garment, if you like, is not made of parts, and it is in perfect equilibrium. And yet its equilibrium is dynamic. It's made up of a continuous interweaving of power motion. And when we focus on any bit of it, or when there is focusing upon any bit of it, that focusing is only an abstraction of a portion of the absolute. And as soon as we begin to believe in that abstraction, the amount of disequilibrium increases. And that is the same thing as selecting a particular conceptual group, finiting it, and thus producing a lower frequency. Now, every time we identify with a finite concept, we are forced off the awareness of the other frequency to a lower level. And according to our all-embracing desire to get hold of the whole world, so is the lowering of our frequency. So if we aim to own the gross world, we have automatically lowered our frequency to get into tune with it. And in so doing, we have put ourselves out of contact with the cause of all things. The initiative cause, spirit itself, is then cut off by our own act of self-finiting, defining the conceptual situation. Now, our only way back is through music, in its original sense. Music didn't anciently mean just what it means to us now, simply sounds from musical instruments. It meant the whole harmonic structure of the absolute. That's how the Greeks would have used the term. But music itself, as we know it today, has produced this preoccupation with the now and the time process, and gives evidence in terms sending the spatial problems of philosophy of a new emergence. When we have gone all over the earth, and we know that it's a globe, we have finished with the space concept, really. And those people who talk about space travel as important are suffering from inertia. Space travel isn't important now. It doesn't matter how many globes we might travel to, it won't remove the real problem, because it will still be in the realm of growth space. But a funny fellow called Johann Sebastian Bach did very funny things with notes, lots of little notes, settling up and down, and so on. He wrote fugues. And these things, strangely enough, affected philosophy. He wasn't the only one, of course, but he was probably the most powerful one in the West in introducing this influence. Because those notes follow each other in sequence, and because of the peculiar nature of the betweenness, philosophers have been gradually led to see that space is not important. We have to find out what time is. Because somehow in that music there is a significance that is not verbalizable in terms of words derived from a gross material spatial environment. In fact, all the words that we are concerned with, if we're not Marxists, as value, relate not to gross material space at all, but to dynamism, to motion of purpose trying to resolve existing tensions. And we don't see tensions on the surface of the earth, although they exist. Sometimes we hear them when there's a volcanic eruption or an earthquake. Those spatial tensions are not there, but they are there in time, not space. Every moment of time is inducing a new tension situation. And every centre of tension produces a strain around it. There's stress and strain. These are all time functions. And music is essentially concerned with this time process and is carrying today's thinkers out of the problem of space into the problem of time. Now, when the problem was about space, it was simply about the dominion of this globe of matter, how to cover it and rule it. But once that has been accomplished, the next thing is, how are we going to endure? And time, being made of moments of now, which have no dimension whatever, because if you try to cut them down in your mind, you will discover that if you can focus on a minute, by extra effort you can focus on a second, and by more effort on a tenth of a second, and so on. Your time process is divisible on the inside, smaller and smaller and smaller, according to the amount of concentration you've got. Now this is the same as the ekacitta of the yogi, it's the one-pointedness of the consciousness. If we concentrate all we've got so that the past and the future don't exist for us, and we squeeze this now moment down to its infinitesimal, then the whole concept of time disappears, because time is flow. And in that now, when we reduce it to the infinitely small, there is no flow. And consequently, the time moment now is a doorway into eternality. Now the philosophers are very occupied with this moment now, but they have not come to the point of considering it as a doorway into eternity. Because they're so preoccupied with this marvelous new discovery that space isn't important. Because time is. And we've covered the globe now. How to conquer time? If we can't conquer time, it is useless to talk about space travel to a star group that might be so many millions of light years away, that no man could leave the earth and expect to be alive when he'd gone one millionth of the way towards it. His lifespan is too short, he can't go that far, he dies. And it is no good telling him about take your wife with you and have children on the way. You see, and they'll get there. All this is meaningless. The whole gross space world has become rubbish. And so they're driven in to find out what time is in the hope that they will be able to extend their gross material spatial existence. And they've already come across this paradox that the moment is divisible on the inside and reduces itself, so that time is only the junction point between a non-existent future and a non-existent past, that having disappeared. And it has no dimensions between it, because the past and the future touch each other, and there's no between. So that now is an arbitrary line where the past and the future meet. Only the past and the future are not two, because it is always the future that travels into the past and disappears. So this now is non-existential. It isn't a material thing. Now is a peculiar experience for the man who can concentrate on it, which is a doorway into eternity. And in the musical experience, what you actually find is that on the sequence of tones, your consciousness is carried with that tonal motion, which is really a motion of betweenness, away from the particulars represented by separate tones, back from those into what is called meaning. Now, if we look at the visual arts, like painting and sculpture and so on, they always refer to something other than themselves. A piece of sculpture of a man, say, Michelangelo's David, refers not to the stone, but to a man that it's sculpted from. A Picasso painting refers not to the painting, but to an idea in Picasso's mind. So that with the visual arts, they're pointing to another thing other than themselves. They're interpreting that thing, but of themselves they have no value. They point to a thing other than themselves. But in music, something quite different occurs. Music does not point to anything whatever. It doesn't point at things. Ketelby might, but that isn't music in our sense. Real music points not to things, but out of things, away from things, in an exactly opposite direction to things. Things are hanging off this spiritual fundamental, you see, and this is the world of contingent relation where the visual arts operate. But music, through its harmonic interrelations, through the stresses and strains that it sets up in us, force us away from the contingent relation, inwards and upwards, towards that essential non-duality of spirit. So in a real sense, music has nothing whatever of gross matter in it. Even when in fact we use, what we do historically use, certain gross materials of wood and catgut and so on, to make these noises, once they are made, they don't point back at the wood. They force us inwardly into certain emotional states, and in the highest music, into psychic and spiritual significances that cannot be attained in any other way. Now, I've said historically we use these woods and so on, but today we find that with electronic means we can produce sound. And in this process, we're needing less and less and less gross matter in order to make these tones. In the early primitive days, we're using phyla, wood, trees, stones, gourds, and all sorts of things, gross materials, and hitting them to get this sound. Today, with electronic means, we are needing less and less and less gross matter in order to produce that sound. And when, on the other side of the electronic size, we come into field processes, field dynamics, we will find that that is the true realm of music. That is the place from which all these tones are abstracted and separated out and made into modes and scales and so on. So we have an absolute non-duality at the top end, characterized by motion, and this motion itself is celestial music. And it is only by condensations of that that there are generated lower frequencies and frequency groups that produce the individuals in the world and thereby give rise to contingent relations. Now when you're counting time in music, you know, you count not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, etc. You don't count equal units of time with equal spaces between them, merely. That's not the way musical time is counted. If we take, say, 3, 4 time in music, and 4, 4 time, 2, 4 time, and count them, we won't go on counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and say that was 3, 4 time. When we count 3-4 time, we stress the first one and leave the second and third slightly less stressed. So we go. When we count 2 time, we stress the first and not the second. When we count 4 time, we stress the first one very strongly, the third not so strongly, and the second and fourth weakly. So we go. And that gives 4 time. Now this causes groupings of prime units. Let us imagine that this other frequency is the basis of our unit system. There is a primary impulse, very short wave, and that groups of these constitute the lower notes of our scale of being. And we have to group them in the only way possible, by stress. So if we take this continuous absolute scale, all the units are the same. But if we tap them out strong, too weak, we get a waltz sound out of it. And if we tap them strong, 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 then we get 2-4 time out of them. We are making groups. Now this grouping of impulses is the cause of the structure of crystals, the generation of the mineral world, and it's the cause of all the differentiations later in the organic world, right up to the production of concepts like philosophical, sociological, psychological concepts. To represent this grouping fact, you will never find a conductor just beating his stick up and down like this with equal beats, because that wouldn't help the officer at all. If you want to conduct in 4 time, he brings his baton down, takes it over to the left, over to the right, and up. 1, 2, 3, 4. The reason he does that is so he can have a strong beat on the downbeat, and that guarantees a grouping. Now this grouping process is just the same in the mineral world. A force comes in very strong and passes out and goes back again, and strong. And thus groups together these primary units of the other frequency together into crystalline structures, which are later to be organized by further complex modes of counting. If we want to count 3 times, we go down, strong, weak, weak, down, weak, weak, down. We have a pattern. So down, weak, weak, down. The very beat that the conductor uses is a triangle. In the 4 times, it's a cross. Now, in elementary conducting, that's what you would be taught to do. And you will still need it in complicated conducting in order to keep the pattern of the music and not let it degenerate into simple metronome time. Now, metronome will kill you dead. And the virtuoso on an instrument knows about the metronome, but he plays rhythmically. And the rhythmical pattern is an enemy of the metronome time. Yes, as the metronome time kills rhythm. And yet metronome time is underneath all the time. And it's by shifting, going slightly off beat, that the stress occurs. You delay the attack, or you advance the attack, you anticipate, and so on. And out of this comes all the complex structures that you can see under a microscope in the crystalline rock. And out of these, organized, broken down, and reassembled, comes organic life. And out of the intake of these patterns, which are the, in their entirety, the logos spermaticos, the whole formal spermatic energies of spirit, out of these, assimilated as food, come the patterns of thought processes. So that thought itself is essentially and fundamentally harmonic geometric. Right at the back of all, we have this other thing, with all its family impulses on it, and itself inducing rhythmical groupings. And once those groupings have been brought to be, they are individuals. And those individuals, being themselves spirit, are free wills. So they can, in fact, please themselves, whether they stress themselves excessively, which is the meaning of the fall, or whether they ally themselves with other groups into harmonic structures. Every individual man is already a harmonic structure. He can please himself, whether he tries to isolate himself, condense himself, lower his frequency, and thus blind himself to causative processes above him, or whether he concentrates on gaining the quickness to assimilate the thought patterns of other beings, and thus to elevate himself progressively towards Aleph level. Remember, the Dionysian thing is only in opposition to the Apollonian.
Yes.
Apollo is an orderly system to bind you and stop your initiative.
You must have a relationship,
yes, it succeeds. Apollo is in charge of music with Hermes. Hermes invented the lyre and gave it to Zeus because of something he'd done to Apollo. Apollo is the very principle of order. It has to do with this spherical being and the reverberations within it. But the new spirit must come in because of the harmonic progression need. Once we make an Apollonian system, we've made a finite, and that is within the field of Aleph a disequilibrium. Aleph initiates a change and therefore occurs in the Apollonian structure as a Dionysian force, that is a devil force. And yet Dionysus is the Messiah, just as Christ broke down the rabbinical tradition. So Dionysus is breaking down the Apollonian bondage.
Now, this other point, this now, when you practice the exercise of this continuous series of thoughts, you appear to take off the individual stress, is that the time concept of exercise?
Yes. All non-identification is time transcendence.
You've actually stayed the time process then.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the real shift into this higher frequency fundamental.
Yes.
So if you shift into this higher frequency by stilling fear or thought, what determines the awareness that follows that state? What has determined it? Is it soul stress?
The determinant is spirit. Because you cannot begin to want to do it until you've gone down far enough. The prodigal can't want to go home until he's been sitting with the pigs long enough. The fact that you want to turn round is evidence you've been picked up. If you do want to turn down from inside yourself, that is, you can be made to want to turn round prematurely by seeing somebody else. But if you do, you will not stay turned round towards spirit. Supposing Jesus Christ came in and radiated all sorts of wonderful coloured lights, and then you thought, oh, I like going to radiate such lights. That would be a misconception. You'd orientate yourself towards spirit to get the lights.
Well,
and you wouldn't get the mites, and then you'd discover that you'd been misled. You'd have to go down again. You'd be disgusted, you would turn away from it. And you'd drive back into the prodigal behaviour. Because you cannot turn around until you hit the bottom. The attempt to turn around before you hit the bottom only occurs under the stress of a success stimulant from another being. And it never lasts very long.
Did you, in actual fact, say that you could integrate and that's fine music?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So, by the same argument, you could cure people by music.
Oh, yes. Music is one of the biggest therapeutic agents there is now. As a matter of fact, music is keeping more people out of mental hospitals than any other single force.
Another thing I want to ask, on this low fundamental and the high fundamental, riding on it, if you are applying your energy rationally to a problem and you receive an answer by grace, has there been a certain amount of energy put in at the
not in order to produce it.
Not in order to produce
it. No, in an attempt to produce it, perhaps, but it does not produce it. What it does produce is a blockage below. And when you are brought to the level of impotence, when you know you're no good at the low end, not before, you stop striving. At the moment you stop striving, there's an influx of spirit. But you can't stop that striving until you've really blocked yourself. Your primary egotism will want to make a success from the bottom end.
So that you really practically exhausted yourself from the bottom end before.
Oh, yes. That's a precondition of it. That's another aspect of humility. Unless you realize that as a finite, you cannot do it. And you sit down in black despair because you've tried your best and failed, you cannot open yourself to spirit. Because egotism wants to do it from the bottom out. So, to make sure that you open yourself to spirit, you should drive yourself as hard as you can to solve the problem at the gross level. For instance, make a public declaration that you will do so and so, which is very difficult. That you actually do it. Declare your aim. Absolutely untaoistic. In the Tao, it says, he who does not declare his aim cannot be said to fail. It's true. Supposing you say, oh, well, I will declare my aim, for this reason. In order to save face, I will drive myself like mad and I will fail. And when I have failed, and not before, I'll sit down in despair, and at that moment, I will open, and spirit will come in. The reason it doesn't come in so often is because people don't fail. And the reason they don't fail is because they haven't got the courage to essay. People are so cautious about failure that they won't commit themselves to anything. And this is that round decaying crime. Not blowing hot, not blowing cold. They play safe all the time. And as long as they're playing safe, they are closed.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't slide your foot along it, it won't cut you. Let the pressure be vertical and at right angles from the blade.